The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to the show. I am your host, Soraya, as always. And tonight, we're going to be talking to Scotty Roberts, who has co-authored a book with John Ward entitled The Exodus Reality, Unearthing the Real History of Moses, Identifying the Pharaohs, and Examining the Exodus from Egypt. And both authors have a different take on this, despite it being kind of interweaved in this book. And at the end of December, we'll be talking to John Ward about his view. But for now, how are you doing, Scotty? Can you hear me?
Hey, Soraya, I'm here. Sorry, I had my mute button on and it wouldn't click fast enough for me. I'm doing great. And I have to say this about John Ward. While he has a very intriguing theory, it's good that you put him way over at the butt end of the year so he can express his theory later. You know, we have a running joke. We were signing books at the Paradigm Symposium. And John would, one day he wrote in one of the books, he said, this was the book for David Weatherly. And David had talked on tulpas, and so I wrote in, as I was signing it, I said, David, much like a tulpa or a thought form is John Ward's theory on Moses. I said, it's transitory, it's visionary. And I said, you might not even see it. And, and I signed it Scotty. And so John writes, he says, David, you'll find that Scotty's theory on Senenmut is Moses. He says, it's intriguing. And he says that you can find the entirety of it beginning on page 288. And then you turn to page 288. Well, the book only has 287 pages. So there you go.
Actually, both your theories have very compelling aspects to them.
They do.
Initially, I was thinking yours probably had a little more evidence behind it, but by the time I was to the end, I'm like, I don't know. They both have very compelling arguments, and they're very different theories. And the thing is, and you point this out in the book, we don't even know if the Exodus from Egypt definitely happened.
Well, there's no direct archaeological or historical evidence that is out there and glaring in your face that said the Exodus took place. Like, you can find that, say, like Ramses II in the Battle of Kadesh. It's all over the temple walls at Karnak. It's all over the Ramesseum. You can find it. You know, some of the facts might be dubious because they paint the picture as, and the mighty Ramses, it was his final arrow that went into the heart of the enemy's king and ended the war and won the war. You know, who knows if that really happened that way.
Right.
But same now with the Exodus. There are certain things that look like they are evidences in Egyptian history, even more recent discoveries. The only problem with them is that there's nothing that directly correlates to anything. Never mentions Moses, never mentions the story as it's told in the biblical passages. And so you're left to believe, and as I state in the book, sometimes where you don't have direct historical archaeological evidence, you sometimes have to rely on the secondary archaeological evidence to establish plausibility. And I think that both John's and my theories establish a good plausible case. And something I have to say about the two of us writing this together, we have different points of view. We are congruent on some points where we meet in the middle on certain aspects of this, but we found each other's theories absolutely intriguing, yet we had our reasons for believing and writing about the established theories as we saw them. But I think this book will do one thing for people. It will show that people who are academics or writing on academic theories don't always have to be at each other's throats if they disagree with each other.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? And so while we have two different theories, we come together and say the conclusion really is we don't know for sure because there's no direct evidence, but we've established two different cases that are very plausible.
Why don't you tell people a little bit about your history and how you got decided to get into investigating this?
Sure. Well, Moses, as I say in my own personal preface to the book, Moses has followed me my entire life like hound's feet, and I don't know why. You can get into the spiritual or the esoteric or, dare I say, the paranormal aspect to establish some of this. And there are things I couldn't write about in a book where we were trying to be very open to the general public, but there are things you couldn't say because the academics would just laugh you off the page. But all that to say, there are things that have followed me my entire life. My first brush with Moses, I was 11 or 12 years old, and I was doing a report for Sunday school. And we had five or six guys in our class my age, and the teacher said, he assigned different topics, and he says, Scotty, I want you to do a report on the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And he said, I recommend you go talk to Chucky Ayling, was the man he recommended. Now, I met with Chucky Ayling, who was at that time did not have his PhD or was in the middle of working on his PhD, but he became known as Dr. Charles Ayling. He's been, he became the president of the seminary I attended 10 years later. He is also an Egyptologist, an archaeologist. He is an egg-headed, little, bald, horn-rimmed glass-wearing professor with that Indiana Jones slant to him, only in a very biblical sense. He's very fundamentalist, evangelical Christian, and that's his standpoint. So I went and talked to Chucky Ayling, and he told me that he believed the Pharaoh of the Exodus was Amenhotep II, and he gave me some reasons why, and I wrote a little 100-word report on that, 200 words, a little paragraph. So fast forward to 10 years, as I mentioned, I went to seminary, and Dr. Ayling was the president of our seminary, and so I sat under his teaching there. I wrote papers on the Exodus there. I wrote papers on my first one of my big papers. It was not a thesis, but a big paper for my seminary studies was on the educational of the 18th dynasty that Moses would have encountered if he indeed lived during that period and lived in the palace. Prior to that, in my high school years, I had done a comic book version as only a 14 or 15 year old can do, and did it in colored markers. It was very detailed, and I actually won a scholarship through my church on the basis of that to attend for 3 years, my high school years, the Fourth Baptist Christian High School, which again then put me into this college I went to and then put me into the seminary I was into. Yeah, and so after that, Moses had always been of great interest to me. I read a lot of different work on him. I was very much in my religious faith aspect of believing who Moses was. And that followed me for quite a long time. About 18 years ago, some old friends of mine and I from college, we did a set of biblical trading cards that we wanted them to look as cool as Marvel and DC Superman and Batman trading cards. And they were very big in the early 90s. And we did a set, and it was called The Ancient Heroes. And we did several characters from the Bible and write-ups. And so I wrote these, and I illustrated them, package designed them, and I did a section on Moses, and really got into it there. And so Moses took up a lot of, as an illustrator, which is what I did in my early years, illustration and design, actually has a great presence in my life there. So in one aspect or another, Moses has followed me. When I wrote my first book for New Page Books, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, 2 years ago, that book, I included a chapter on Moses. And this is where I thought I could really get my feet wet and express some of these things about Moses I wanted to, because the Nephilim are while it's become almost like the Anunnaki, it's become a word that's used in the paranormal, in the ancient alien theorist camp.
Yep.
Nephilim has its source in the book of Genesis. That's where it's sourced, in Moses' writings. And so I wrote a chapter on Moses, and I called him Moses, or I called the chapter the Pharaoh God of Israel. And I talked about how Moses, what he would have brought to the table, the education he would have experienced, the religions he would have encountered, and probably.
And I believe we might have lost him.
He did. For 80 years of his life, from Egyptian religion to Sinaitic religion. Oh, did you lose me? Sorry about that. Skype. Gotta hate Skype.
From what I can tell, it just kind of paused and then sped up to catch up with you.
Okay. Well, in this book, I write about Moses and what he brought to the table. The religions of the first 80 years. If indeed he lived a life as described in the Bible, he was not a Jehovah worshiper or a follower for the first 80 years of his life, until his spiritual epiphany at the burning bush. And what he would have brought with him when he started writing the books, the Pentateuch, into that 40 years post-Exodus, he would have incorporated Egyptian religion, Mesopotamian religion.
And I think
Syrian, Canaanite religion, all of these things are incorporated there. So really, Moses has been I'm sorry, we're having problems with the connection here.
Yeah. So, it's
am
dropping.
I here now? Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you now, but it keeps dropping out and then putting you in super fast forward.
Oh, you know, I have had that happen to me before, too.
If it keeps up, we might have to call you back on a landline.
You know, I do have a phone where you could reach me, and I'll give that to you if you have to call me.
Yeah. Well, we got that. So,
all right. That's really how Moses has been a permanent fixture in the back of my mind most of my life, and he started coming out in my writings. Also, in my second book for New Page, The Rise and Fall. I'm sorry, The Secret History of the Reptilians. I talk about how Moses, I believe, created Judaism out of whole cloth, incorporating ancient stories of the Anunnaki from the Mesopotamia. You look at the cuneiform tablets describing the creation of mankind with Elil and Enki, Ea, and these gods of the Mesopotamians, and you find direct correlations 1,500 years later in the writings of Moses. Mm. Now, it was either one of two things. Moses borrowed that information and created Judaism out of whole cloth, or there was some proto-religion that existed, and these are just different versions of that. So whichever it comes down to, those were some of my experiences really with Moses throughout my career.
And you actually have some of the comic book artwork in this book, and it's actually very impressive considering how old you were at the time.
Why, thank you. I learned to draw looking at comic books. And became an illustrator and a designer and an art director and eventually a creative director in advertising for the last 25 plus years. Hmm. So, and I did all of this alongside, I was a youth pastor for a while, alongside my career as a creative director and an art director. And so Moses is somebody that's always intrigued me. And I wanted to get away from the storybook Moses. There were some things in when I was a teenager, when I did the little illustrations and stuff and won the scholarship. Those were all very Charlton Heston, Ten Commandments. Right. And then when I got into my later years, not that I'm elderly, but when we did the ancient heroes cards, I wanted Moses to look like a Sinaitic sheikh, which is what he was in that second 40 years. He was an old guy. He was between 40 and 80 years old, if the biblical story is accurate. And he had a career as a sheikh there in Midian for 40 years before he went back to Egypt with his spiritual epiphany. And so I wanted him to have that look of that what the Egyptians called the Asiatics, the Canaanite, the Bedouin tribes, the sheikh of a Bedouin wandering type of a mobile tribe in the Midianite region in the Sinai. And that's where my illustrations reflect some of my historical study.
Now, there are a lot of people who will say that you can't take the Bible as a historical document. And personally, I think that's ridiculous. There's always going to be some truth backing up religious documents at some point, unless maybe you're talking about Scientology. But the ancient documents seem like you just have to figure out what's story and what's reflective of actual history.
You know, I have a big problem with people who say, oh, the Bible, oh, that's unreliable. It's all fiction. Well, there might be some fiction contained in there, but I divide the Bible up into two parts. I say there is a faith story, which in faith, you don't need to have proof for anything because it's faith. If you want to know your religion or your faith deeper, you're going to start looking into things, which I did. And there is much of the Bible's history that is spot on. Just because a document is a book of faith does not mean it cannot contain efficacious history. If we threw out every source book we used in archaeology and history, historical studies, that was a book of faith in ancient times, we would lose 98% of the material that we use. And so what you have to do is you have to go to history and compare it.
The priests were also the historians back then.
They were indeed. And I think what you've got with the Old Testament as we see it now, our Old Testament in the English Bible now is based on the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Hebrew Old Testament. And that was rewritten or recompiled by the 72 rabbis in the year, right around the year 400, in the 4th century BC. And what happened was after the captivity of Israel by Babylon, all these people are finally released and they're sent back to their homeland in Israel. And the temple has been ruined and the cities are in destruction. They go back and to rebuild their culture. And the rabbis who went, they went to Ptolemy II, the Greek pharaoh of Egypt in the 400s BC. And they went to the Library of Alexandria and begged permission to go into all the documents there and to rewrite the Old Testament, to rewrite their books of the law, the Pentateuch. And their goal was to do two things, which are noble things all by themselves. They wanted to, one, bolster the faithful Jews of Israel and who have been in captivity for several hundred years, and they also wanted to reestablish a history for their nation. Now, in so doing, could they have embellished? Could they have exaggerated? Could they have gotten some things wrong in the rewriting? According to the legend of these 72 rabbis, they put them in 72 different cells where for months they sat and rewrote these things from oral tradition and some remaining manuscripts, and they recompiled, and then they compared all their notes and put it together, and we have basically what you would call the Septuagint today, which is the Greek version of our Hebrew Old Testament, which has been, of course, then translated to English for the Old Testament that we have. And the problem with that is they made edits, they made updates, they made exaggerations. Who knows if they took the story of the Exodus and embellished the hell out of that story to create a wonderful mythic picture, legendary character of Moses. But I still think the man existed. They just turned him into legend. He became Hebrew legend. And it was for the purpose of establishing the faithful and establishing the history of their nation.
What I found interesting about that is that there were 72 scribes, which is a processional number.
Oh, yeah. You get 72 writers nowadays on the same topic and put them in 72 different rooms and see what they come up with. And they're supposed to be talking about the same thing. You're going to have lots of different versions. Of course, a scribe had a... also had a certain spiritual calling. He had an obligation to his nation to write in a very different style than we might think today. I don't think they were as free and loose-handed with interpretation, but I do think that they embellished certain things. One point in particular as it relates to our book that I'm going to bring up is that for years, centuries, it was believed that Moses encountered the Pharaoh Ramses II. And you see it in the Ten Commandments. You see it in the animated The Prince of Egypt and all different kinds of stories that are out there. It was always Moses versus Ramses. Now, the problem with Ramses, as I see it, is he's way too late in history. He's 200 to 220 years too late for the biblical dating system.
Why would you say that?
First thing I'll say is this. The reason they established Ramses is because these rabbis, when they recompiled the Septuagint, they wrote that the children of Israel, when they were captive in Egypt as slaves, built the treasure cities of Python and Ramses. Now, we all know, if you know your Egyptian history, Ramses built those cities. They were his treasure cities. So if the Hebrews built those cities, obviously they lived during the time of Ramses, and that's when the Exodus took place, according to interpretation of that. The only problem is that what the what the scholars were doing when they wrote Pithom and Ramses. They were giving the current place geographical name to a very old city called Avaris, which lie underneath Pithom and Ramses. All Ramses did was rebuild Avaris, and he renamed it Pi-Ramses. And it was a city that had existed 200 to 400 years earlier. And if you do, they've done excavation work at Avaris, which lies beneath Pi-Ramses. And they have found a huge a settlement of common people. Enormous. Thousands of people would have lived there, and they found many different Semitic relics there in funerary styles, belts and buckles and buttons and things like that. They were all very Semitic. There's no parchment left or papyrus left or inscriptions, but they found these things that give evidence that Semitic peoples dwelt in this city of Avaris. Now, Avaris would have been built about 300 to 400 years earlier than the time of Ramses. And Ramses is 200 years later than I believe the biblical dating system tells us. Now, you ask me the question, why would I say this, that it's wrong? If you look at the biblical some biblical passages, and there's even dispute on some of these amongst, you have to be either a biblical minimalist or a maximalist. You're one that either says the Bible is very minimal, I don't believe any of it is accurate, maybe a couple of tidbits. The maximalist will say it's all true. You can take even the faith element out of it, but everything else is true. Now, what they are finding, archaeology over the last 150 years has really proven that a lot of history in the Bible rings true archaeologically. Now, there's a passage in the book of 1 Kings 6:1, and it talks about Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel. Now, there's dispute as to whether David and Solomon ever even existed, especially among your minimalists. Now, by the way, they are finding more and more evidence of David's palace and David's structures and Solomon's temple in Jerusalem just in the last year. And it's amazing the evidence they've come up with. But let's set aside for a minute that there's dispute over whether Solomon existed. It says that, and on the day that Solomon dedicated the temple in Jerusalem, which archaeologists refer to as Temple One, in Jerusalem, the first temple built by Solomon, it was the 480th year since the Exodus. Now, those are nice, that's a nice round figure, so you don't know if that's been just rounded up or what. But the first temple built in Jerusalem, if you believe it existed, and if you believe the archaeology as opposed to being a minimalist, that if you believe that Temple One was built in Jerusalem, which there is much evidence for, that would have been mid-10th century, so right around the 950s to the 960s B.C. The median date they plug in for the building of Solomon's Temple is 966 B.C., as a median, give or take 3 to 5 years in either direction is all that they vary on that date. So if that is indeed accurate in the biblical chronology, that a temple, one, was built in 966 B.C., thereabouts, give or take a few years, you date that 480-year figure and you end up with the date of about 1445 to 1446 B.C. as a date for the Exodus. Then you can go to Egyptian chronology and see who was on the throne in 1446 B.C. And there are at least 5 or 6 different chronologies of the Egyptian kings, ranging from 20 to 40 years in difference. And so they jump all over the place, depending on when somewhere down the line somebody plugs this pharaoh in as, oh, he was only a co-regent, or, oh, he was actually the same pharaoh who ruled twice under 2 different names. And you get these chronologies that go all over the place. The closest one I found is the accepted Oxford chronology of the kings comes very close to those dates for the pharaoh that I believe was the pharaoh of the Exodus. And remember I mentioned Dr. Chuck Yaling? Mm-hmm. He told me it was Amenhotep II. Now, Amenhotep II in 1446 would have been about 23 years old. He was in the 5th year of his reign. He was co-regent for the first 2 years of his reign with his elderly father, Tutmosis III. Now, Tutmosis III, if you go back 40 years, earlier from what would be the date of the Exodus, Tutmosis III took the throne 40 years earlier. And this was at the death of Hatshepsut, his stepmother, who became the female pharaoh of Egypt. And a remarkable queen. Compare her to like Queen Elizabeth of England, Queen Elizabeth I, and you get the idea of Hatshepsut. Now, at the time of when she became pharaoh, her husband, Tutmosis II, died very early, age 29. And she was left, and she claimed that her father, Tutmosis I, had actually wanted her to rule. And she became the co-regent with her stepson, who I mentioned, Tutmosis III. He was only 3 years old at the time. She was his co-regent, and in the first 6 years, she completely deposed him as pharaoh, and she took over for a good 20-plus years as the pharaoh of Egypt. Reigned for a very peaceful reign. The people loved her. But during this time period, she had a man that she raised to great height in her kingdom. Now, let's go back for a second and review these dates. If the Exodus actually took place in 1446 under Amenhotep II, and if Moses was indeed around 80 years old, as the biblical chronology states, go back 40 years to when he's 40 years old in Egypt, where the Bible says he murdered an Egyptian taskmaster and buried him in the sand, then thought he was going to get caught, said, surely Pharaoh knows of this deed, and he runs off to the land of Midian, where he lives for 40 years before his burning bush experience. Now, at age 40, Moses leaves Egypt. So if you date him back another 40 years to his birth, he would have been born by this chronology right around 1526 BC. On the throne at that time, this would have been during the first year of Tutmosis I, the pharaoh of Egypt. And his daughter, Hatshepsut, that was her throne name, her regal name. Her real name was Matakare. Matakare was about 7 to 10 years old at this time. She bore the title Pharaoh's Daughter, which all royal daughters who were heirs to the king bore the title Pharaoh's Daughter. So when you see in the Exodus passage in the Old Testament, Pharaoh's daughter found Moses in the Nile, that is not at all far-fetched. It's a title. Hmm. So now you go to, so Moses, his life in Egypt, he would have lived under Tutmosis I, Tutmosis II, Tutmosis III, and Hatshepsut. And if at the let's take this back to the Egyptian side of things and who I believe is Moses, because now this is very circumstantial, it's speculative on my part because there's nothing in the Egyptian record that ties him to Moses except for extrapolating the circumstantial evidence from the chronologies and from the events that took place. Now, Senenmut, in 1486, the year that Moses, by the biblical chronology, would have turned 40 and murdered the Egyptian and fled, is the same year Senenmut was around 40 years old. But for the previous 20-plus years, 30-plus years, he had been a steward in Queen Hatshepsut's household. Now, this stewardship is far more than a servant. She actually named him Senenmut. All we know about Senenmut in Egyptian history, the Egyptian records say he was born to commoners, which could be an interpretation of a slave people or a subjugated people. Could be. Now, there's more to it than that. But he was born to commoners. He's brought into the house of Hatshepsut at a young age, early teens, I would say. He becomes the steward in her household. He is the tutor to her royal daughter, Nefruri, the daughter she had with her husband, who was also her brother, Tutmosis II. Now, Senenmut is this tutor. Now, tutors were not what you think nowadays, a little school marm or a school man, you know, that is wet behind the ears, educational, and that's all he does. They were generally men who had established themselves as nobles or were in the nobility class or of the house of Pharaoh or great military leaders. So Senenmut is placed as this steward. Then she ends up over the next few years bestowing on Senenmut over 92 different royal titles. Amongst them, she names him the Grand Royal Architect of Egypt. She names him the Grand Vizier of Egypt, which is basically one step off the throne of Pharaoh. When Pharaoh was away or absent, the Grand Vizier was Pharaoh. And she even gave him his name, Senenmut. It doesn't say what his name was prior to that. All it says, he was born to commoners, and she named him Senenmut, which means in Egyptian, mother's brother. It means, I, your mother, am elevating you to the status of brother to the gods with me. And this is the name she gave him. Now, he ruled as the grand architect. He built her great temple of Jeshur Jeshuru at Deir el-Bahri in Luxor, that grand, magnificent temple you can see today, you can go to today, in the cliff faces there. He left behind 9 statues of himself with the young daughter of Hatshepsut and supposedly her husband, the pharaoh Thutmose II. But in each of these statues, he is holding this young child in loving embrace. And it's a young girl. And there is some theorizing that says Senenmut was so close to the queen that he may have even been the father of Nefruri, the princess. And interesting things about Senenmut is that it is also, think again of the reign of Elizabeth I of England. And she was tied up with Essex for years. And with Robert Dudley was her great love of her life. And they never married. This is the kind of relationship it is said that Senenmut and Hatshepsut had, that they were lovers. There was a romantic involvement between them. And she elevated him to the status of brother to the gods with her. And now here's something very interesting. When Senenmut, when he's around age 40, around 1486 BC, the same year the biblical chronology places Moses as being 40 and fleeing Egypt, Senenmut is 40 and he completely disappears off the Egyptian record. He's left behind 2 glorious tombs. He's left behind these 9 statues. He's left behind inscriptions where it says, I, Senenmut, the sole friend to the queen, he calls himself. This glorious one tomb of his is right at Jeshur Jeshuru, right at Deir el-Bahri. It's on the northeast corner, is this glorious tomb of his. They're both the tombs he left are unfinished, never used. No remains of him found, no record of whatever happened to him, no record of his death or funerary processions or anything. He just disappears off the record. Now, keep that in mind in that kettle of fish. Within a year of Senenmut's leaving, Hatshepsut dies. And Thutmose III, the deposed co-regent, her stepson, takes over as the rightful place of pharaoh. He's now about 30 years old, 33 years old, something like that. He takes over as pharaoh, and he starts striking all of Hatshepsut's images from her temple, from all of her inscriptions. And it was thought for many years that he did this because of a great hatred he had for Hatshepsut. But it's been found in recent years that he only did a little bit of this. It's called erasure. It's where you can go and see certain inscriptions, and they've scraped off the old pharaoh's name and put in the new pharaoh's name. This is why when you find like Ramses II 200 years later, all of his inscriptions of his name, his cartouche, are all deep in the rock, like 2, 3, 4 inches into the rock, so they can't be scraped off and erased and replaced. But Thutmose III starts this erasure but leaves off on it. He only does enough to establish that he is the pharaoh. It has now been established that 40 years later, when he is in his elderly years, becomes co-regent with his son, Amenhotep II, my candidate for the pharaoh of the Exodus, that it was his son who at age 18, 19, 20, says, you started the job, we need to wipe out every image of Hatshepsut. And he refers to as that lying, deceitful bitch of a woman, his aunt, his mom's stepmother. So they wipe out all of her images. But what else does he do now, 40 years later? Now, this is the time when Moses, who I believe was Senenmut, would have returned to Egypt as an 80-year-old man with the let my people go. And what happens at the time he erases all of Hatshepsut's images off of everything? Amenhotep II also erases every image of Senenmut at the same time. And destroys his statues. And the 9 that were left, I believe, were found in a pit or something. And those statues still exist today. And so when you start looking at circumstantial evidence, and that's just the tip of the iceberg of what I go into in the book. But my candidate for Moses is Senenmut, a man who was very close to the Pharaoh, a man who would have held a great position, a man who was considered a brother to the gods because the Pharaoh made him so, a man who was one step off the throne of Egypt as the Grand Vizier, a man who had all his images erased at the same time as the Pharaoh by the man who would have been the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And I believe he did this because he was erasing the name of the man who brought this calamity on Egypt and took the slave culture out. Now, there's several other historical points. There's things like the Bible talks about the conquest of the land of Canaan 40 years after the Exodus, when Moses dies and Joshua takes over. And what's one of the first things they do when they march into the land of Canaan? They have the scenario, the big story at the city of Jericho. You know the old story, Jericho and the walls came tumbling down.
Right.
Now, the Tell Jericho, Tell, T-E-L, Tell Jericho, exists today. It's still inside the confines of the city of Jericho. It's the ancient site of the ancient city of Jericho. And it was looked at 100-plus years ago, and they found that the walls were indeed all crumbled down. And an interesting point, in fact, without saying it was a miracle, we're saying it's interesting that many of the walls were tumbled down outward from the city. And so as if from the inside. But that tell existed, and one thing they have established archaeologically and with carbon dating and other historical remnants around it is that the city of Jericho fell, on this tell, fell in right around the year 1400 BC. And it was not occupied again for 600 years. It was 600 years before anybody rebuilt that city. It stood vacant and arid and just a waste in the sand. Now, the interesting thing is the conquest of Canaan. If this happened 40 years after the time of the Exodus, 1486 BC, I'm sorry, 1446 BC, right around 1450, you have the conquest taking place in the first few years of the conquest of Canaan, some 40 to 45 years later is the destruction of Jericho. And this is one of the other reasons you can't use Ramses. Ramses ruled 200 years later. If the Israelites left Egypt and then went on 40 years later to conquer Jericho, it was 250 years too late for the dating of the destruction of Jericho, and nobody lived there for 600 more years. So you have archaeological facts that are around this that establish plausibility without being able to say direct archaeological evidence. Now, since I've written the book, I've come across new finds that they've come across in the last couple of years. A stone, I cannot off the top of my head remember the name of the stone, but it's a stone that shows the dividing of the waters and people passing through. Hmm. And this is dated to around the time of the 1446 Exodus. I did not look that up for this radio show. It's just on the top of my head, and it might come to me. Then there is also, now what you think of him, I don't know, but Shimka Yakubovici, he had a show on the History Channel called The Naked Archaeologist for years.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And he would take biblical topics like the Exodus and many other things. He's the one who did the Jesus Tomb special with James Cameron, the big Titanic and Avatar director. They did the Jesus Tomb, and they did something on the Exodus. And he talked about the Danoi out of the Aegean Sea area, the region of the Aegean Sea. And without going into all of that, there was a tribe of Israel that after the Exodus parted ways with Moses and moved to the north of what is now Israel. They parted and they did not wander for 40 years with the rest of the tribes. They took off and said, "See ya, we're going somewhere else." The tribe of Dan. Now, it is said that Dan settled in an area of northern Israel, which is known for the Phoenicians and the Sea Peoples, which were from the Aegean, and they intermingled with those people. They also, by the way, are said to have mixed with the remnant of the Anunnaki, and they spread across Western Europe and even into the Celtic Isles, and they established a lot of the ruling houses of Europe. It's one of the legends that goes with them. You look at the Irish legends of the Tuatha De Danann, the children of the goddess Danu. And they are also known as the children of the the children of the Anu, the Tuatha De Anu of the Anunnaki. And they intermingled with the remnants of these tribes that worship the Anunnaki. And they are also part of the Aegean, and I'm not going to go into the whole lesson on this, but they are part of this Aegean Sea culture that came in and became known as the Danoi. And they settled in north of Israel as the tribe of Dan. And they were known to have sea power. And there are grave caps that relate them to the Danoi. And there are Danoi grave markers that have no verbiage on them or text, but they show a history of the Danoi as people having come from up the rivers from Egypt and crossed the Mediterranean and settled there. And they have depictions of chariots chasing a man with a staff into parted waters that are inscribed on these. So all of this is it's secondary evidence because nobody knows what it really means. It seems to be plausible evidence to establish some connection to the Exodus. So while I talk about sentiment in circumstantial and speculative terms, I believe the speculation and the circumstantial evidence is so well rooted in plausible evidence that this is my candidate
hang on, we got to take a quick 45-second break, and we'll be right back with Scotty Roberts.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we've been talking with Scotty Roberts about his new book, The Exodus Reality, co-authored with John Ward, who we're going to have on at the end of December. And sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off right there. I just need to squeeze that in.
I talk too much anyway.
So let me ask you this. You didn't really go into much to the parting of the waters.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I can tell you this. The way I dealt with it in the book is I kind of brushed it off because I said there are many miracles, the 10 plagues, the parting of the waters, the ground splitting open. There's absolutely no way to establish that those things ever really took place outside of a faith story. However, that does not mean that faith story was not built on actual events. And where I don't try to minimalize miracles, I do not for an instant want to say that God does not exist. And if God does exist and he's the creator of the universe, would he have the power to part waters? Sure. But we don't know that. There's no way to establish that outside of actually having been there or actually just believing the faith story. So what you have to do is look at the route that the Exodus would have taken and where they went. First thing to keep in mind is the Red Sea is mentioned in the biblical account, the parting of the Red Sea. And it's a mistranslation. It's actually the Sea of Reeds is what they're talking about. And this is just north. If you look at a map of the Middle East and you see the Sinai Peninsula and you see the two fingers of the big expanse of the Red Sea, one is the Gulf of Aqaba, which goes up on the Saudi side, and the other is the finger of the Red Sea that goes up on the Egyptian side between Egypt and Sinai. This is where they said the Red Sea crossing would have had to have taken place. But of course, you have to remember where the Israelites, according to the biblical passage, dwelt. And this was in the land of Goshen, which has been established to be where the city. Remember we talked earlier about the cities of Pi Ramses, mm-hmm. Pithom and Ramses, and Avaris, which existed before that beneath those cities. That is right in the delta area east of what is now Cairo. And that is where the land of Goshen existed. It was a fertile piece of land. Now, if they left from that point, there was an arc that you can follow. If you look at a map, you can even see it in satellite pictures of the map. There's a wadi, or a waterway will be, that would flood in the rainy seasons and so on. But there's a wadi going from the fertile delta area in kind of a low arc to the straight east from the land, from Cairo, what is now Cairo and Goshen, across the desert over to the Red Sea. But just north of the Red Sea, right now you have the Suez Canal has been dug through there and connects it to the Mediterranean. But just north of the Red Sea are what they call the Bitter Lakes. And the Bitter Lakes contain a lake called the Sea of Reeds, which falls right on the end of this wadi, the Wadi Tumulat. It's referred to as this path that would have been taken. It was an ancient trade route as well. And it says the Israelites crossed on dry ground when God parted the waters. It says, now, what the movies always get wrong, it always shows Moses saying, you know, stand and see the mighty hand of God. And he stretches the rod over the waters, and the waters part miraculously in front of them. However, the biblical passage reads, and Moses stretched the rod over the waters, and a strong east wind blew all night and parted the waters. And the Israelites passed on dry ground, with the waters standing as a wall on the left and a wall on the right. Now, what is embellishment and what actually took place? Right now, in that region, the Bitter Lakes, prior to the Suez Canal being in there, were very shallow lakes. You could probably walk across them knee-deep. And there is a phenomenon that takes place even at times today where the east winds blow and they dry up the higher portions of the lake bed, and you can walk over on, quote-unquote, dry ground. Is this a natural phenomenon that took place when it says, and a strong east wind blew all night and parted these waters? Could the armies of Pharaoh, if pursuing them into this, could they have been trapped in there? Yes, because of some of the tidal waters that would have been associated with this. From the winds dying down and the waters raising very quickly, you could have men that could have been killed in this. So the biblical miracle versus a natural event, sometimes you have to say, maybe if God exists the way he said, the Hebrews said he did in the Bible, would he necessarily use miracles, or would the miracles have been that he utilized natural occurrence? We don't know. As John Ward says, Scotty, we don't know. We weren't there. and that's what really governs us in a lot of that. So I kind of brush by those rather quickly and say, I cannot attest to the veracity of a miracle, but what I can tell you is that this is what existed there, the Sea of Reeds, the Bitter Lakes. And when they crossed that region, this wetland really more than anything, they turned south along the east side of the Red Sea, traveled about halfway, midway down that finger of the Red Sea, and turned inland, and we believe stopped at the mountain about 30 miles inland, the mountain in the Sinai wilderness, called Serebet El Chedim. And the Bible actually mentions Serebet El Chedim by a different name as one of the mountains that the Israelites stopped by. And so the question we ask is, could the mountain of God been more than one mountain? Could Serebet El Chedim have been the mountain of God? John and I were there in the middle of God-forsaken nowhere, Sinai Desert, this last January. And you're in the middle of these rocky mountains that are more like plateaus. They're flat on the top, a lot of them. This was a big mining area for the ancient Egyptians where they mined copper and they mined turquoise. On the top of Serebet El Chedim is a 4,000-year-old temple to the goddess Hathor. Now, Hathor is many times is depicted as a calf or a cow, the goddess of fertility and happiness for the ancient Egyptians. And her temple existed up on top, and there was a community of priests that lived there to Hathor. And there are several chambers, if you will, that were built out by successive pharaohs for 1,500 years from the cave of Hathor, the original place of worship up there. And down on the flats below this mountain, John and I, there was a full moon that night, and we're standing out about midnight in the middle of the Sinai Desert in the wilderness. The only people around is, we were guests of Sheikh Barakat, a Bedouin sheikh who lives there, and he put us up in a Bedouin, tattered Bedouin tent for the night, and we're sleeping on the desert floor with his sons, his elder sons, sleeping all wrapped up in camel hair blankets, protecting us over the night, guarding us as a courtesy. And not that there was anything there to be afraid of, but they were there as a courtesy to their guests. We stood out in that moonlight and looked up at the silhouetted mountain of Sarabat el-Khadim. And John and I were musing with each other. We said, what if that is the place? Could you imagine, and in the silence of being in the middle of the Sinai Desert, you could hear in your mind's eye the crackling of fires, the cook stoves, the chatter of people, the singing, the animals, and they would all have been waiting there as Moses went up into the mountain. And what's very interesting is on the top of this mountain, it's filled with old stelae. Now, stelae up there especially, they look like, think of a stereotypical curved-topped gravestone in an old cemetery. And that's a stele. That's the look of it. And they were inscribed on both sides with hieroglyphs. They're all over the place on the top of Sarabat el-Khadim, this windswept. It's not a tourist site. It's an attraction in the middle of the Sinai Desert, for God's sake. And we climbed up this mountain to the top. We were at this temple. There were piles of discarded stele that were either things that they threw out in the day, 3,000 plus years ago. There was a big mound of them, and they were stelae inscribed on both sides of different hieroglyphs, different stories, and they either cracked or they broke or they discarded them for some reason. Now, the biblical account says Moses came down the mount with the tablets of God inscribed on stelae on both sides. And you know, again, circumstantial, but what were the Israelites doing down below according to the biblical account? They came to Aaron and they said, where's, in the vernacular, it actually reads this way in the Hebrew, where's this guy, Moses? He led us out, and now we haven't seen him he's up in the mountain for weeks. Let's build a god. And what did they build? They built a replica or a facsimile of the Egyptian goddess Hathor, the golden calf. And they said, this will be the god that we're worshiping. And you know why? Because they're at the mountain where the temple of Hathor is at the top. And this is what happened there. And it's a very interesting story when you start looking at the historical archaeological facts and start comparing them to what happened at the Red Sea. And that's what we were first talking about. I believe they crossed the Sea of Reeds on somewhat dry ground, and I believe that they were being pursued and that army was destroyed in those waters. Bad timing, you could say. There was also one thing that John and I mused about as we were driving through this area where the Bitter Lakes are. John said, you know, over there a few miles is the Well of Moses. Now, we couldn't go there. We were in the Sinai. We were stopped at a checkpoint by the police, sat for a couple of hours, a little nerve-wracking at the time. And John pulled up his email on his iPhone, and he said, oh, listen to this. We're sitting now, mind you, at a police stop with guns, and there's nothing else there except this police stop, and we've been detained for an hour and a half already. John pulls up his email and says, oh, the British government has just said they're advising no travel into the Sinai for British subjects. And so there we are. And they finally brought a pickup truck with three soldiers and old AK-47s, and they waved us to follow them, and they drove us. They were our protection to go into the Sinai. They drove with us for 2 miles, pulled over, waved us on, and turned around and went back. So we were on our own in the Sinai after that. But John said right over there would be the Well of Moses. And this is a well that's existed for over 3,500 years, has been the traditional spot, and it's called the Well of Moses. This was a well that belonged to the Egyptians, which, of course, water, as we know, fresh water in these regions was a high commodity. There would have been a garrison of Egyptian soldiers stationed at this well. And we mused, do you think there was any embellishment that when they crossed the Red Sea and the armies of Pharaoh chased them, did they encounter the garrison at the well? Because the Bible says they went to the well and had a little confrontation. Could this have been the army that pursued them rather than 50,000 chariots, which seems pretty excessive?
Right.
But also an interesting point that I want to bring up is during this time period, if Amenhotep II was the pharaoh of Egypt, he went on 5 very successful military campaigns during the first 5 years of his reign. He was barely home. But there's one point in the scripture, if you're reading the scriptural account in Exodus, he says to his people, he says, Where are my slaves? Where did they go? And this is after the death of the plague of the firstborn. And they all take off. And it's almost as if he's asking, like he wasn't there. He said, what happened here? Where are my slaves? And here is a plausible theory that was put forward. And I write about this in the book as a theory. And I say, now you remember how we talked about grand viziers and they were actually the pharaoh in the absence of the pharaoh. I'm wondering if Moses or Senenmut may have encountered grand vizier Rechmir. And grand vizier Rechmir was actually, in Egyptian terms, he was pharaoh in the absence of pharaoh.
Right.
And when pharaoh returned and saw everything was decimated and gone, he goes to Rechmir and says, what the hell just happened to my country and where are my slaves? Now, this is speculative, but the reason I bring this up is Rechmir dies very shortly after this episode would have taken place. He's buried with honors. He has a wonderful tomb. But on the tomb of Rechmir is where you get the wonderful paintings, and I have photos of it in the book in two different places, of Semitic slaves making mud bricks, of carving stone, of working under hard labor. And this is on his tomb paintings. Now, I wonder, Rechmir would have been about the same age as Moses in his early 80s, and he would have been a contemporary of Senenmut. Senenmut was placed as the high priest. I'm sorry, as the high priest, as the grand vizier under Hatshepsut. But when she dies and he disappears, Rechmir is placed as grand vizier at age 40 to 45 by Thutmose III. And he reigns all the way as grand vizier 40 more years into the reign of Amenhotep II and dies in his early 80s. There is some speculation that says perhaps this is the character that Moses encountered. And perhaps the hardening of Pharaoh's heart had a lot to do with, and the eradication of Senenmut's images post-Exodus had a lot to do with, Rechmir was a contemporary of Senenmut 40 years earlier and knew this man well, at least 40 years earlier. And that this led to the great animosities. It led to possibly the defacement of all of Senenmut's inscriptions and every mention of him and every image of him and the burial of his statues. So it's speculative. But again, you have to look to establish plausibility.
All right. We're just about out of time. I had one quick question for you. One of the things you mentioned here is the adminations of Ipuwer. Is that my
saying? The Ipuwer papyruses.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, they are only dated to about 1500 BC, but they date even earlier than that is what many scholars think. But if they're around the 1500-year mark, this aligns, it coincides with the possible exodus.
And they list basically the 10 plagues of Egypt Egyptian source.
Yes, they do. Without calling it the 10 plagues, without referring to Jehovah or miracles, they talk about these 10 destructions, these admonitions, atrocities that took place. And John refers to a lot of that in his theory as well.
Okay, but in the book you say that you don't really feel they're valid. Why is that?
Because I think they're dated too early. I think they're from an older story. It's part of Egyptian legend.
Hmm.
They're a little too early for the Exodus, I believe.
All right. Okay. What's your next project?
Well, John and I are working on a book right now for New Page Books on the lost armies of Cambyses, a Persian king who destroyed Egypt in the 500s BC. They went out into the western desert of Egypt to destroy the miracle, the oracle at Siwa. And as Herodotus writes, ancient historian writes, and a great sandstorm engulfed the armies of 50,000 men, and they were never seen again.
Hmm.
And they still to this day haven't found. But John and several archaeologists think they have found this out in the western desert, remnants of this army.
Wow.
And so we're writing about that. And we also have, John and I, are leading trips to Egypt. We started the Exodus Reality Adventure. And we're going February 12th through the 26th. We're retracing our expedition. We're bringing along with us psychic medium, Chris Conway, Scottish medium. You may have seen him on the show, the Brit show Most Haunted. He parted ways with them for various reasons, many good reasons. But he is coming along to lead a paranormal branch of this tour. And if you want to join us on this tour, we have some seats left open. We're only taking 10 people along. You go to Exodus Reality exodusrealty.com. The same as the title of our book. And don't go to Exodus Realty. It's the wrong site. It exists. It's the wrong site. But it's exodusreality.com. We'd love to have you come along.
All right. And any idea when the new book will be published, roughly?
We don't yet. We're still in the proposal stage with our publisher, who said, get me that proposal so we can get you going on this book. It will more than likely be the end of 2014, the beginning of 2015.
All right. And you're definitely doing Paradigm Symposium next year, right?
Definitely doing it again next year. It's going to be, we believe, we're just firming up venue locations. It's going to be, we think, the first weekend in October. We haven't got all our speakers lined up. We can't announce anybody, but there have been some very good names thrown about for Paradigm Symposium 2014.
Nice. All right. And where can people find you online?
You can find me at, you can go to my own personal website, which is just my full name, Scott Allen Roberts. Allen is A-L-A-N. There's like 10 different spellings of Allen. So scottallenroberts.com. You can certainly go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and look up The Exodus Reality. You can find me on Facebook. You can find John and I have a group on Facebook. The group is called Exodus Book. We named that before we'd actually titled the book. And you can find us at exodusreality.com.
All right. Well, I thank you so much, Scotty. Good speaking with you again, and a great book. I definitely recommend it for anyone who's interested in this this subject, because you definitely both have some very interesting ideas and circumstantial evidence behind it.
Yes, it is circumstantial, but I think it's plausible.
It is definitely plausible, and we'll have John Ward on the last weekend of December.
And he'll fill you in on, he believes it was Amenhotep, son of Hapu, the high priest under Amenhotep III, about 80 years later than my theory.
Right. So we'll get to talk to him and find out why. All right. Thank you again, Scotty. And Psyche Corporation taking you out. Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection? 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you?